Welcome to the Eucatastrophe, where we meander through politics, pop culture, church, and society to consider true human ends and how life may be enchanted. My name's Joel, joined as always by my co-host Dave here. Look, I have to make a correction. In the last episode, I referred to quantum qubits. And immediately after the episode, our producer Liam, he just spent about 20 minutes educating me on the Q standing for quantum and what that means. And I still don't know, but there you go.
What's a battle? Did you just say what's a battle?
I think he said what's a battle. But we move on to something that Liam, you know what? I don't need to care about this guy, Liam, anyway. He just referred to the Star Wars films and said, are they good anymore anyway? And I'm like, no pizza for you, Liam. So the Rise of Skywalker trailer, Dave.
Yeah.
You've been airing heretical suspicions.
Yeah, I mean, I think it looks beautiful. I'm just really worried that J.J. Abrams is just going to repeat every plot point from Return of the Jedi. So he doesn't seem to get the difference between making allusions and making things like cyclical and just doing a carbon copy.
Wow.
So like Force Awakens, the big critique was beat for beat, everything that happens in it is exactly what happens in New Hope.
Yeah. Look, I've got two questions. One, why aren't you accepting that Return of the Jedi is the greatest of all the films? And two, what have you got against Joy?
Listen, I love it. I love The Force Awakens as well. I just loved Last Jedi so much because it kind of played on themes and motifs from the original films without just regurgitating.
So weird that you say that now when I know you are giving money. you are giving money to
I know
create,
exactly where this
to
is going.
Create the new film, scrubbing Rey out of it.
Yeah, and Holdo.
Yeah, Holdo.
Yeah, that's the name of
Well, admittedly, those scenes at the casino where they
were terrible.
They were pretty terrible.
But overall, yeah. Like the fight with the Praetorian Guard.
Look, I'm looking forward to this film, unlike some people.
Okay.
Because you know what? What does it say in the trailer? Something like every generation ends, but the story goes. It's just like speaking to my heart.
Yeah.
You know, and something's wrong with yours.
Yeah. Well, something's wrong with yours because you can't stay up late enough to go to a midnight screening with me.
He wants me to go to midnight screening. I have to wake up at like 6:30 in the morning every morning. Yeah.
Well, if Tim can come.
It's hard, man.
Surely you can as well.
Oh.
He's doing important things like tool videos.
And think about it. Mm. Yeah.
All right. What are we talking about?
We're talking about disagreement.
We are talking about disagreement. Like you
that.
Know, that there's an objective good and that good is Empire Strikes Back. And
get to the point.
Okay. So this is where I admit that the last episode and this episode kind of came out of my frustration with an utterance that happened on a daytime telly show, a daytime talk show, namely that of Ellen DeGeneres. So my social media feeds, both for the podcast and my own personal one, were swamped with this speech from Ellen, where she was defending herself from this controversy that apparently arose because she was filmed buddying up with George W. Bush at in a private box at a football match of some description.
It's American football, NFL.
Yeah.
It's all right, you'll get it.
And now apparently this caused some controversy originally, like, well, how could you associate with someone like this? And then she did this moving speech, which in particular Christians seemed to be very interested in, whereas I found it utterly infuriating in a way that I'm probably giving too much credence to her and too much kind of energy being directed towards something so banal. But anyway, this is what she said. She said, here's the thing. I'm friends with George Bush. In fact, I'm friends with a lot of people who don't share the same beliefs that I have. We are all different, and I think we've forgotten that it's okay that we're all different. For instance, I wish people wouldn't wear fur. I don't like it. But I'm friends with people who wear fur. But just because I don't agree with someone on everything doesn't mean that I'm not going to be friends with them. When I say be kind to one another, I don't mean only people that think the same way that you do. I mean be kind to everyone. Now, Christians that I follow, particularly conservative Christians, absolutely ate this up. And they thought this was a wonderful call to tolerance of people that particularly they loved seeing a progressive calling for tolerance of people that are more associated with the right. And I think there's probably pretty obvious reasons. I hope it's not too cynical to say, well, we're at a time when people think that conservative Christian sexual ethics are now not worthy of moral consideration and things like that. And you can understand why hearing a progressive figure call for tolerance and friendship with people that disagree with you would be appealing to Christians. But I actually found this scene incredibly infuriating for a number of reasons. First of all, I feel like it kind of crystallized this deep solidarity at the heart of two forms of liberalism. So we've talked about this a number of different times a few episodes ago, where we talked about how there was two different kinds of liberalism. There was a kind of progressive liberalism that saw the state as needing to provide the necessary goods to pursue an authentic life of one's choosing. So that means freedom from discrimination, the provision of social welfare and things like that. So that being one form of progressive liberalism. And then there is classical liberalism, which sees the state as just the arbiter between competing individuals, creating a space of for a free market and the free exchange, freedoms from constraint on exchange by traditional forces like substantive teachings about what goods are worth pursuing in the market and things like that. But that also ends up turning into a kind of imperial free market where if there are places in the world that have commodities that should be treated in a free market, then it's the obligation of the liberal order to bomb those markets until they're free.
Or to treat individuals as, you know, labor available for contract work in the most degrading circumstances.
So we might call it neoliberalism and a progressive liberalism. And I think this instance actually signifies that at heart, there is a deep solidarity between these two forms of liberalism. And this is something that we've been talking about a lot on this podcast.
Yeah, you could say, you know, like we were saying last week, they both agree on, I keep using the phrase because it just so captures it so nicely, but they both agree on what Walter Soff calls the excellence of freedom, right? Or you could take it into the American context. What I found, because I think, I know this is not going to be the main discussion, but just to pause on it for a second, there seems to be a solidarity, as you put it, on what Catholic thought would call the heresy of Americanism.
Yes, that's right.
Right, you know, so I
so they're both American exceptionalists.
Yeah, and I can agree that he loves America, I love America, don't we both love America, and that's what ultimately matters, right? And what does America stand for? It stands for some conception of freedom.
Yeah.
Right, and so this is what...
the autonomous individual.
Yeah, and this is what, in some Catholic thought, they talk about it as a heresy because it places America and its understanding of freedom as the sort of ultimate end rather than, you know, potentially a good, but one that is situated within and provisional and with respect to some other ends.
So that's kind of part of it. I feel like it's kind of symbolic of this, that at heart, progressives and neoliberals are in alliance to create this kind of environment of atomized individuals in competition, which has outworkings in kind of horrible geopolitics. But secondly, I think this event showed, I hope it's not too harsh a word to say, a bit of kind of political theoretical buffoonery on the part of a lot of people, because and it's endemic to bourgeois liberalism, I think, to reduce substantive, horrendously catastrophic political decisions to mere difference of opinion. Mm. So the reduction of, say, creating a state of exception that has lasted 20 years, destabilizing an entire region of the world, normalizing torture, creating almost perpetual warfare.
Death.
Death of millions. This isn't a difference in opinion. And the capacity of the liberal system to turn historical, like once in a generation, geopolitical stuff ups or sins to just, well, he likes, I don't know, raspberry jam, I like apricot jam, is utterly ridiculous.
Or even, you know, so there is capacity to disagree on things, obviously, yes. right? So not every person who says, I have concerns about, say, an open border
yes.
migration is being a racist yes. necessarily, right? Yeah. So there are genuine questions around how do you order a society with generous immigration and so on.
Yes. Right? So but, what I'm wanting to talk about this episode is how do you distinguish between a grievous, undefensible moral evil and difference of perspectives yet aiming at a common good or a commonly recognized good, perhaps in different ways for different reasons.
And I think then there's two sub-questions under that, if I can add to it.
Yes.
One is whether there is, whether distinctions can meaningfully be made between a person's sort of public persona and their public action and what yeah. I'd characterize as their public virtue.
Yes.
And their character.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
So one of these things that comes out of this is that people say
so Ellen, for example, says George Bush, he's a lovely man.
Lovely man.
Yeah.
I don't agree with his opinions.
Yeah.
Right? Or lovely man, I don't agree with their public actions. Yeah. So there's a is there a distinction that can be drawn between the character and the person's public persona in that way? Or is character in that sense continuous? And actually, yeah. Virtue should be the discourse that runs through it. So that's one sub-question. Then the second one, I think, is that the nature of friendship.
Mm.
Right, so she's making a claim to be friends. That raises a question.
Mm.
Okay, because I don't think it's necessarily a problem that she's friends, right? I think it just raises the question about what does that friendship look like given the, you know, that continuous character of virtue into public action and so yeah. on.
So to clarify, I'm not here advocating for a kind of political Marcionism. So Marcionism being, you know, that you have a good God and a bad God and everything is can be reduced to some sort of cosmic black and white good and evil. I think it is really important to maintain friendships with people who have differing views and things
and
like that.
And it's clear that there is a sort of Marcionism yeah. that takes place in some contexts. Right?
Yeah, that's right.
So some people do actually have, yeah. I think, a list of right opinions.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think the problem there is more that that actually cheapens the nature of friendship and political deliberation.
Yeah, that's right.
Because you can just have an easy tick box.
Yeah.
They agree on this, 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 as opposed to, okay, they're actually part of some mutual conversation. Yeah.
And there's good reasons why we disagree. Because we live in a environment that produces epistemological problems. We see things in a mirror dimly. And so when practical reasons at play, we might have different understandings of the best course of action. You brought up the issue of immigration, for example. So there'll be some serious disagreement about acceptable levels of immigration that can't be reduced to whether you're a racist or a laissez-faire open borders person. Because there's an understanding that we're actually seeking some sort of good and there's goods that need to be brought into balance there. Our duty to our neighbours and our duty to, say, the poor of our own nation and things like that. These are serious questions of practical reason that there will be disagreement about. There's disagreement about the nature of goods default that we follow. There's and there's disagreement about the ways that we pursue those particular goods as well. So that's all to say that I don't think that one side of politics is right and one side wrong, but I do think that there are certain types of political decisions or political opinions that are morally undefensible and shouldn't be respected. and how you work out that difference is quite difficult.
Yeah, I think, but it goes back to what we were saying last week as well. There's always a regulative feature
yes.
taking place. So there are always going to be some things that are beyond the pale, some things that cannot be tolerated.
Mm.
And I was suggesting last week that toleration and respect, well, I think it can operate on one of two axes.
Mm.
One, you can tolerate something because it's inconsequential.
Yeah.
Right? It just doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And it makes no difference. And so, oh, well, you know, somebody likes jam. Mm. You know, I don't. Well, I do like jam. Depends on the jam. Mm. But, you know, maybe you don't. Inconsequential.
Jam's doing a lot of heavy work in this conversation.
But secondly, the thicker understanding of respect and so on is that I understand this person is also contributing to a good that we hold in common. So John Milbank gives an interesting example of pacifism. Why do we respect the pacifist if you're not a pacifist yourself?
Yeah.
Right? And he says reason being because they point to, if you don't agree with them, they nevertheless point to an exaggerated understanding of a good we share, namely peaceableness.
Yeah. Right?
And so always what we have there is we're rooted in a common conversation about what is good for our common life. What does it mean to for the individual to pursue their good in, together with others and form a community of right living or worthwhile living and so on, right?
Yeah.
So that means that I think the way you distinguish these things is sometimes it is because somebody's opinion necessarily or their actions rather, opinion seems so weak a phrase for this, right?
Yeah.
Their actions place themselves outside of that conversation.
Yes.
Now, where you draw that boundary is very difficult. We have obviously we have huge questions over sexuality, right?
Yeah.
And I've argued in different pieces I've written elsewhere that we need to understand that there is, even for a society that has accepted extending marriage to same-sex couples, that those groups, traditionalist Christian groups, traditionalist Muslims, Orthodox Jews, and so on, that they are nevertheless contributing to goods in common like education and pursuing it within an understanding of relationships being virtuous through fidelity and so on that is expressed within opposite sex relations and marriage and so on, right? Mm. Now, that's an argument, and I'd say, and I've said this in the context of different things around gender and sexuality.
Mm.
Now, some people want to say that, no, this is beyond the pale, right? I don't think that's right. I think there is definitely, I think there's room for, you know, that polyhedron that Pope Francis was talking about, as I mentioned last week. But there must be some things, always, any conception of political life rules out certain things, right?
Yeah.
That says these things. Now, that then means we have a question later for how we treat that person who's doing this, how we treat them in friendship or not.
Yeah.
But as a matter of politics, we have to. And now, how do we do that? Now, I don't. I've got some thinking on this around, you know, the church as an authoritative structure.
Mm. Yeah.
But it is difficult.
Yes.
Right, to choose this and not that.
Yeah.
We have done it, right? Let me just build on that point about the church, right? So. Our synod, our synod gets wonderful, you know, just wonderful media coverage and so on, of course, in the Sydney Diocese of the Anglican Church.
Mm.
It does, however, has on occasion, you know, it's clearly stated its position against detaining children.
Yeah.
Now, that means that as a collective body coming to discern what its understanding of the good is in this context, right?
Yeah.
And so then you have a problem because then we have politicians who do this.
Yes.
So what does it mean then to be friends with that politician in a context where my body of people have authoritatively stated that detaining children in these circumstances, you know, or
is indefensible.
Or not even, I mean, it's because the argument now is that children have been released, right? Yeah. But actually the indefinite detention of these people is indefensible, right? What does it mean then to be friends with a politician that is engaged in that action?
Yeah. And I think earlier on, like our Archbishop at the time spoke out against the war in Iraq and spoke at rallies, spoke against reforms to industrial relations, which would put pressure on families and things like that. So, yeah, so I think the question actually goes beyond just friendship. What does it mean to be in communion with people who do these things that are contrary to the teaching of the church? And there's been, I think I'm getting ahead of myself a bit at the moment, but you know, just recently, Joe Biden was denied communion at a Catholic church, I think, in Italy.
No, it was like was in one US? Of the southern states.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
And then again, I saw a controversial discussion going on someone's Facebook wall recently where he's in the United States and he said that he's an Episcopalian theologian and he was saying that ICE agents should be denied communion. And he goes, you know, basically liberals say, you know, it's just about what's in the person's heart. But in both these instances, the church is wanting to make a declaration about the unacceptability of the actions of the person. Now, my problem with liberalism, especially in Sydney, liberalism being political liberalism, is it seeks to maintain the possibility of someone having an authentic, genuine level of virtue or the presence of virtue within someone's character and heart, the presence of compassion while they engage in these horrendous political acts. Mm. So, for example, our former premier, when he retired, a lot of my Anglican brethren, and mainly brethren, were saying, singing his praises as what a wonderful human being this is. Whereas I thought, no, wait a minute, this is someone that has advanced authoritarian police practices, kowtowed more and more to the coal industry in New South Wales, has kind of advanced anti-protest laws and things like that. How is that commensurate with a Christian understanding of character and virtue? But there's always, people always push back and say, no, no, you don't know his heart.
Yeah, well, there's
but
two...
But that yeah. seems that, that and the same could be said of George Bush, right? So Ellen says, you know, he's a great, lovely man. He does things I disagree with, but he's a lovely man. And I think I want to problematize this capacity to distinguish between objective political acts and someone's character.
Yeah, so I okay, so there's so much I think what you just said, right? So so one is that you're again pointing to how it's not just, so some people think of it as just, it's just mere opinions and how can we really say something's outside the pale because we're just engaging in the contestation of politics and we take a majority vote at the end or something like that, right? Well, we have to engage in a noisy argument to say what is for the common good and some things that are actually going to be contrary to that and that has consequences. But then your point there about his character, the person's, you know, almost their individual character, what's in their heart of hearts and these sorts of characterizations, and then what their public actions are. You know, partly I want to respond by saying, I don't care, right?
Well, like, this is what I was saying around when Mike Baird was like, I don't really care about his character.
We've raised this before,
he needs
right?
to give an account of his actions.
I always loved it, you know, we've raised it before how I said, you know, in a meeting with him, I said, how do you understand your role as the executive? You know, the government in relation to the churches, and his response was, I'm a good guy. You know, and I thought, this is just nothing. That's just, what is that? Anyway, so there's that. Partly I don't care. You know, like, I mean, they're exercising public office. But then also, I think fundamentally, there is continuity to character and to public action. And I think there must be. Because what I'm not someone, you know, we mentioned before how some people want to just have a checklist of right opinions and they don't care about, you know, how that person maybe lives their life and on, right? I actually think, no, what we want is we want people in public life who exhibit public virtues.
Yes.
And one of those virtues is justice, right? To act justly.
Yeah.
And you can't cultivate that virtue if your character is flawed, right? You can't, and we see this, I think, increasingly with politicians, for example. You think about the expense scandal in the United Kingdom. These are people that had accumulated, they had taken up upon themselves self-interest rather than affection for the common weal, right? They're taking self-interest as their modus operandi.
Yep.
And then it results in public chaos.
Yes.
Or you say people who have self-interest and then you get into instances of corruption, right, at public level and so on. Or you think, you know, if you have an understanding, for example, in your private life that education is for the sake of just simply getting your children ahead in the market and so on, that would undoubtedly shape and discipline as habitual practices how you then think of education for the society as such. Or we mention it with consumerism, right?
Yeah.
If you're just a really shitty consumer who just throws your trash on the ground, right? You know, you see some people do this, just kind of they're having a cigarette, then they just throw it on the ground sort of stuff. I don't think that that must, I think, as a seamless garb, have some impact upon how you understand public virtue. So, you know, Pope Francis in Laudato Si talks about, he begins Laudato Si by saying, we have sinned. And we need the reforming light of God to change our vision. And then we can, and in order to then act justly in relation to each other and our common home, right? So this idea that somebody has good character, but, you know, may have the wrong opinions or may engage in the wrong public actions is, I think, really problematic. I mean, I think it's true. So Obama has this thing that people are sharing as well, where he says, you know, those people you disagree with, they may love their children. Absolutely right. But then the question is, have they allowed that to not be generous enough?
That's right. It's good to appeal to the common humanity of your political opponents, right? So that's a good move. But their common humanity needs to be manifest in acting humanely.
So you're taking the segregationist South in the United States. Absolutely, they love their children. That's wonderful. Now they need to use that as a basis. Exactly. It needs to be used as a basis to expand and so on. So, okay. So,
For example, George Bush might love his country, but that solidarity with your fellow country person needs to be expanded to a love of humanity in general.
Right.
That doesn't mean that we don't have particular obligations based on our relationship to our co-patriots. But patriotism is not an all-excusing virtue.
Okay, so I've got
one thing I want to say.
Oh, I've got two.
But getting back to this kind of pragmatism that's present in a lot of liberal discourse. So someone looking at someone that makes these kind of what I would call kind of wicked political decisions that can't be defended because of on grounds of practical reason and all those things, qualifiers that we gave before. Some people will come back and just say, well, that's just what politics is, though. It is just a war between competing interests, and it's up to the opposition to call me out if that's possible. But my job as a politician, like my job as a business person, is to just try and get my way as much as possible without being called out. And, you know, you see this beginning in Machiavelli. So virtue has nothing to do with politics. The politics is about the assertion of the will and the maintenance of power.
I think we're now seeing the signs of that, we now have a degraded politics.
So now people constantly make excuses for these public figures and saying, like, no, they're virtuous people, but they're
in
this thing. But I want to say, by buying into this picture of politics as just this realm of pragmatism, you actually generate that reality.
Absolutely.
And so you are co-authoring that reality.
Look, and I think you could track in different Western democracies, for example, the decline or in parliamentary democracies, you could track the decline of individual ministerial responsibility. Mm. This is the idea that if a minister is responsible for their department, their staff under it, and their actions within their portfolio, and that traditionally, if there was some form of wrong action that was of a severe enough level, they fell on their sword. Yeah. This doesn't happen that much now,
so
right?
Hannah Arendt calls this the rule of no one. So we've created a bureaucracy. Bureaucracy.
Well,
being,
it's not about. I didn't mean in terms of just
when she says bureaucracy, she means the claiming of agency by individuals within a system.
Right. Okay. So there is that. They can claim that it was other agents or agency was diffuse. But there's also the absence of responsibility because in party politics now, there's a sense that you shouldn't take responsibility because that could be harmful to your political interests of your party and so on, right? Yeah. So the very idea of politics, as you just
said,
which
is straight from business, right?
It leads to a degradation and a mistrust in politicians. Now, I wanted to just raise two things, right? One, building off what you just said.
We should finish with friendship.
That was the second. So the first one I wanted to raise, building off what you said, is what you see now is this curious thing happening in which different politicians, typically more on the right now, are appealing to and saying, hey, guys, we need reasonable disagreement. We need to allow for reasonable disagreement. Something that I am in favor of in many contexts, right? And actually think is necessary to building that common life, you know, in that way that I said before, like the polyhedron that we talked about with Pope Francis last week, right? But what they're doing with it, you see ScoMo this week, right? Mm. ScoMo this week is suggesting that we should prohibit secondary boycotts. Yep. So this is when a corporation or a person tries to boycott mining companies.
ScoMo is our prime minister.
Yeah, Scott Morrison. So a finance company says we're not going to lend money to Adani.
Yep.
Or a supplier says, you know what, I'm not going to lend my equipment. I'm not going to sell my equipment to this supplier, and so on. And the reason they do that in part is because other people put pressure upon them. We won't use your services if you're engaged with that. And he says we're going to crack down on this. And he explicitly framed it by saying, because this is to stop those people who won't allow disagreement.
That's right.
And I thought, wow, this is fascinating because he's taking the language of disagreeing well and so on, things that we've talked about and I've written on. But and others obviously much more. But like he's taken that language and he's putting it into a context where he's using it to basically say, I'm going to impose pretty draconian laws in a context where people are trying to advocate for what is necessary for our common home.
Yeah, and this is Schmitt's critique of liberalism, right? So that in the end, it just becomes a perpetual conversation.
Debating club.
And it's a back and forth. And when there is a genuine emergency, like the fact that we have less than 10 years to act on our carbon emissions, or civilization is just going to collapse, right? That's the time for conversation is over. But in the kind of bourgeois liberal mindset, there can never be a time when anything but the agonistic public sphere is the answer.
Right.
And so it can't comprehend of these things like the exerting of civil responsibility through precisely civil disobedience, stepping outside of the system. Things like Extinction Rebellion, for example.
Everything should be procedural.
But that's not the procedure.
Okay, so the second point.
We haven't talked about.
No. The second point is that we're like past our time, but we need to say this because what I think is important to say here as well, with say the example of Ellen and George W. Bush, what a great example, you know. Anyway, is that it's not saying they shouldn't be friends, right? I don't think so. I don't think it's saying they shouldn't be friends in the sense of like.
I think friendship in this context. Needs friendship with
a
sovereign.
No, it's about defining friendship.
Okay.
It's about defining it. Okay,
friendship
so
is
that.
A call to repentance.
Exactly.
In this
so you could take it at the very end of it, the very base level, right?
Yes.
Base in multiple senses. If you were engaging in reprehensible conduct, right? And clearly contrary to right ends of relationship, you are harming your community and so on and so on. I'm talking Dave here, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, happens a lot. Yeah. We have to have this conversation weekly.
Over and over again.
We have the conversation, right? Because you are my friend,
yes.
I actually engage in, so to love you actually means exhorting you to act rightly, right?
Yes.
And trying to engage in persuasion. Now that friendship then, as you're suggesting, I think, takes on a different sort of component when we're talking about speaking to the king or the...
That's right.
Or, the
sovereign.
The sovereign, right?
So, yeah, and so if one of my favorite scenes of a play is A Man for All Seasons, which is the story of Thomas More's trial for sedition or treason for speaking out against Henry's divorce. There's a brilliant scene right at the end where he's been sentenced, where he declares that it's because of his he's on trial because of his Catholic faith, basically, and then. Then the prosecutor says, see, you've proven it. You're malicious. And he says, not true. I remain the king's true servant. Mm. And how is he the king's true servant? Because he is fulfilling his job as a Christian of calling the sovereign to account, to calling the sovereign literally to give an account of his actions and demonstrate how they are consistent with Christian doctrine. And this is something that needs to happen. I mean, Horowitz talks about this with George Bush, for example. The problem with Bush is he claims to be an authentic Christian, but does not submit himself to any ecclesial authority.
Same Christian with Trump. Same Christian with all of them, really.
And so, and then the liberal world is shocked when Biden, for example, the church actually says no. Like, you've actually got to.
We've talked about this with Scott.
And Pence, the same thing happened with Pence. I think, is he a Mennonite or a
Well, you remember when ScoMo came to power, right?
Yeah.
We said in a different iteration of this show, we said, the interesting question here is how do Christians react? And a lot of the reaction was just like, he's a good guy.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought, no, can we go back to, Theodosius and Ambrose, man?
Yeah.
Whether he's going in sackcloth and ashes, this sort of stuff. But actually that relationship that is, friendship in that context looks like discerning action, discerning statements of judgment to say an exhortation to say act rightly, pursue justice, walk humbly.
That's right. And so this might be a nice way to end the show, but the one of the most kind of badass theological moments of the first millennia of Christianity was when Theodosius had engaged in basically a massacre of Christians in Ephesus. And then went to the cathedral to receive communion, and he was stopped at the door by Ambrose, the then Bishop of Milan. And Ambrose was reported to have said, "You have imitated David in his sin, now imitate him in his repentance," and wouldn't let him receive communion. And I think there is a model there. Anyway, all this was sparked by a daytime
Did you watch this on YouTube or were you sitting at home in your underwear and just eating some cereal and Ellen came on?
I wish. No, it was every single, like so many Christians that I know on social media posted this. And I think more thought needs to go into the nature of the possible, or at least more grounds needs to be given to the possibility of genuine, undefensible evil within liberal politics. So my problem is the assumption is always that as long as something is happening in a liberal democratic context, it can't be radically evil. Even if we're doing the same thing that we would condemn in a non-Western, non-liberal country. So, and this is what Chomsky is always going on about your Sam Harris's or your Christopher Hitchens. We do things that we would condemn in other cultures, but when we engage in genocide or war crimes or crimes against humanity, we're doing it as good liberals.
Yeah, and sometimes making the judgment isn't easy.
No.
But that doesn't mean you don't make judgments.
Yeah.
You have to engage in, and we've been saying again and again, the noisy argument as to what is common to our good.
Well, I feel like this has turned into a bit of angry old man yells at clouds, but thanks very much for putting up with us. We're about out of time. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. Like us generally, we're good people, even though we do despicable
even
things.
Even though you don't think Return of the Jedi is the best.
No, it's clearly Empire Strikes Back. This is not
Ewoks
open
dancing
for debate.
At the end. The joy of it. So wonderful.
Please follow us on Twitter at UCAT, EUCAT _ podcast. And please drop us a review. That really helps us to get ourselves out there more. We'll join you next week as we continue the discussion about controversy by talking about disagreement within the church. We'll see you then.